Greetings, my name's Andrew Sumner. My grandfather, Pop Smythe, bought me my first comic book in Liverpool, England, when I was 3 years old, and I spent the next 50 years hurtling around the pop culture kaleidoscope, first as a fan, and then as a journalist, editor, publisher, and presenter. Along the way, I met a bunch of interesting people who will be joining me here, creators, performers, professionals, and public servants. We live in divisive, fractured times, but art and popular culture connect people from all viewpoints and from all walks of life. I'm often struck by the passions people enjoy, that they can set aside their differences for and agree on, whatever those passions are, whether I share them or not. And that spark, that moment of instinctive, connective agreement, that's what I call a hard agree.
For this special occasion, I bought this kind of stork.
That is brilliant because A, you can see me, and why wouldn't you want to see me? And B,
well, of course, the whole of the last conversation, you know, I was doing this because there was like a box on the screen that was covering your face. This was about 12 quid from Amazon or somewhere like that.
Actually, my entire setup, it's brilliant what you can do in the era of Zoom interviews and Zoom conversations, because I set up all my lighting rig and my stand for my laptop very inexpensively via a couple of online purchases. So it is brilliant what you can do.
Yeah.
I want to ease into things just by talking for a second about something we've talked about a lot recently, which is your livery building cover for Batman the Detective One.
Because we're talking about that again, are we?
Yeah, that again. Yeah. Just bear with me. Obviously,
that thing.
Mate, it's done. It's done really well. It's really blown up. The interest in it is very high level. Everybody on two levels, comics fans and Batman fans, have really grasped onto it. I think it's a beautiful piece of work, which it absolutely is. But it's also been very much embraced up in Liverpool, and that story has had real legs. So, you know, we've had so far this week, the books have landed in store. We've had a bunch of people, you know, ordering the books who are not normally comics purchasers. So really, it's achieved absolutely everything we hoped for it, because it's helped widen out the comics message, you know, beyond our usual customers, which is great. Everybody in Liverpool loves it. The feedback.
Everyone
in Liverpool loves it. Yeah.
There isn't a single person in Liverpool who doesn't love it.
That's right. Yeah. Certainly not a single person who's related to me. That's for sure.
Somebody did send me the photograph of the book. We call them books, don't we? We're very posh that way. Propped up in front of the statue of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Also a little Batman figure as well standing there.
For sure. That was the mighty Cat Ash, Catherine Ash, who is actually the manager of FP Liverpool.
Oh yeah.
Cat took those books out because there's a brilliant period of what they call golden hour back at home on the waterside. There's a brilliant hour where when it's sunset, those buildings all massively, because of the aspect, really catch the sunset and have this beautiful golden glow to them. And she took the books over at golden hour and took pictures of the covers in front of the Three Graces and in front of the Beatles. That was all Cat. And when she sent the pictures back the next day, we were like, man, these are really lovely.
Oh, good.
You know, so everybody's really pleased. So thanks again for doing that.
Well, that's okay. Now, I don't actually know these Three Graces you're talking about. There is the Liver building. And what are the other two?
And other two buildings are... There are three buildings, and they're all next to each other. In fact, mate, if I move my head slightly, you see that there, that's the Three Graces at night time, and so it's the Liver building, it's the Cunard building, and it's the Port of Liverpool building. Liver building, Cunard building, Port of Liverpool building, and if you look them up, sort of from an architectural standpoint, they're all very complementary. Yeah. Obviously.
Which is the one that has the Tate in it?
Now, that is an excellent question, mate.
That's not one of them, is it? That's further along.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. Tate Liverpool is in a slightly different spot. Yeah, that is...
I remember seeing the statue of Jerry... Is it Jerry Marsden as a statue of, or one of the other famous rockers.
Yeah, no, the Jerry Marsden. Take Liverpool is at the Albert Dock, which is probably where you saw it. Now I'm going to tell you an anecdote about Jerry Marsden, who left us recently.
He did,
But I knew Jerry Marsden's bank manager, funnily enough, of all things. Yeah, and the reason I know Jerry Marsden's bank manager is because it's my dad. So my dad was Jerry Marsden's bank manager. And I used to meet Jerry Marsden when I was a kid. And my dad had this bank in, he worked for the Midland Bank. He worked for the Midland Bank in Kirkdale. And Kirkdale is slightly out of the town centre. It's like on the approach road up to where the football stadiums are. And this building is still there to this day. It's not a bank anymore, but it was a very imposing kind of granite building in the middle of a bunch of traffic islands. And for some reason, he used to have a lot of like furniture accounts there. And he used to have a lot of music accounts as well. So my dad was Jerry Marsden's bank manager. He was also the bank manager for the Epstein family, Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager. So he didn't work with him when Brian was still alive, but he used to work regularly. I mean, he used to work a lot with Clive, who was Brian's younger brother, and long passed away now, but my dad's still here alive and kicking. But he used to work with all of that, the NEMS business, the Beatles publishing stuff and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a small world after all, you know, Brian.
So did Jerry have any money? Did he have much money?
Oh, yeah, he had quite a lot of money. Yeah, and basically there's a couple of things, because, of course, he didn't have the publishing royalties on You'll Never Walk Alone, which he famously sang.
Oh, that was him, wasn't it?
Was him. It was a huge hit. And it was also adopted as the anthem of Liverpool Football Club. And it is a massive song, because it gets sung several times a week because of the footy. But, of course, he didn't have... That's a song from Carousel by Rodgers and Hammerstein. And so... Absolutely. It gets... I think one of the key characters sings it. It might well be Billy Bigelow, the key character in Carousel, sings it.
I don't know it.
And it's very interesting musical, Carousel. It's very macabre. And it's about a guy who dies and about him then watching his family from the afterlife, basically.
Where is that set? It's an American musical, isn't it?
It's an American musical. Yeah, it's like one of those American Midwestern musicals, a bit like Oklahoma was.
Oklahoma,
which is by the same guys, actually. But it's also got a very famous song, which is beautifully interpreted by Frank Sinatra. It's Gordon McRae who plays the lead character in the movie, not Sinatra. And Gordon McRae's a big strapping guy, but the song is called Soliloquy. And if you ever hear Sinatra's version, it's like 9 minutes long. You know, it's pretty amazing. I'm going wildly off piste here, mate. So
you are,
so
just, aren't you? Yeah,
we've got to get into a whole range of subjects. And also, I don't want to take a hammering for doing 90% of the talking during a Brian Bolland
interview.
This is
going to come across as a Liverpool sort of publicity campaign.
Oh yeah, the Liverpool, but well, you know,
tourism board.
I'm on a lifelong Liverpool publicity campaign. But to really very quickly answer your question about Jerry, he did write Ferry Across the Mersey, which is a big song, of course. And then he spent the last 30 years of his career, he kept on touring, and he regularly toured Australia once a year. And I know that was very lucrative for him. So, you know, he was definitely in good shape. You know,
and we of course did the ferry across the Mersey. I mean, I've only ever been to Liverpool once in my entire life, and it was just in the last 3 or 4 years. And of course, we had to do the ferry, and we got that tune piped at us, you know, as we were going along.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful, though. If you get it on a nice day, it's a lovely thing to do.
But are you sure there isn't another statue of another?
I know exactly who you're talking about. Another one, the other person at the
dock. Who's the other one?
Yeah, I'll tell you. It was a Billy Fury.
Billy Fury. I knew there was another guy there, because that was on the way between the Tate and the Liver building was this other statue. And I did Billy Fury.
Well, yeah, Billy Fury, and check this out. When Billy Fury was discovered, he was actually working on the ferry. He was actually
one of the two.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
crikey,
absolutely.
They all were.
Yeah, so he's got a but he was discovered when he was literally working on the ferry. He was one of
the
ferry
hands. What was his real name? Do you know his real name?
Oh, yeah. Now
we'll look it up. We'll put it on the screen.
Yeah, I'm going to look at it while we're talking. It's one of those things I do know it, but I'm afraid that the rusted door of memory, even though it's there in my memory, it's like the hinges are rusted.
You mean their real names were not Fury and Wilde?
Yeah,
and
no, amazingly, look, Marty Wilde and Billy Fury, Georgie Fame. I do know Georgie Fame's off the top of my head. His real name was Clive. Yeah, I do know, but again,
Clive Fame?
Yeah, you know, Clive Fame, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Are any of them still alive?
Georgie Fame is still alive and is still performing and is still brilliant. I think Marty Wilde is amazing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know who the target audience for this video is, but I'm assuming it's not people over 70. And it's not just for people who live in Liverpool.
No, it isn't. That's absolutely right.
There are
right.
other people.
so real quick, Georgie Fame is Clive Powell. And he still performs and he plays at Ronnie Scott's once a year. I'm a member at Ronnie Scott's, by the way, Brian. So when the pandemic's over, if you fancy going to see him
I've never been there.
At Ronnie Scott's, it will be my pleasure to see Georgie Fame when he does his annual residency.
Is he a kind of a jazz?
He's heavily jazz and R&B influenced. Yeah. He does a lot of jazz, but it's quite sort of R&B. But he's in great voices. His voice is identical to what it used to be.
I've got my computer glasses on here. My regular glasses. That's better. I can see you now.
While you're re-glassing, I'll also tell you that Billy Fury's real name is Ronald Witcherly. Yeah, Ronald Witcherly.
That's right. Now, what about covering something that people under 70...
On that note... I'm going to back us into a real conversation that people who have tuned in to listen to an hour with Brian Bolland have literally got 15 minutes on 1960s music acts and Liverpool. So sorry about that, folks. But I am, of course, here with one of my all-time favourite artists. I don't wish to embarrass you, Brian, but it is a fact. One of my two or three all-time favourite artists. Not only that, but one of the greatest British artists of all time. One of the greatest comic book artists of all time. None other than Mr. Brian Bolland. How are you today, Brian?
Well, I'm very well, and it's, again, a pleasure to see you, Andrew, and to talk endlessly about Liverpool.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is what we do from now on. Now that I've transformed you into a great advocate of Liverpool and be a man who's almost emblematic of comics and Liverpool.
I'm a Liverphile. Is there such a word?
I'll take that word, a Scouse-phile, maybe.
A Scouse-phile.
Yeah. Yeah, I won't get back into I did take a bit of a hammering on certain areas of social media about the amount of time in our interview that I ended up talking about the recipe for Scouse.
I think so too.
I'm not going to do that this time.
I shall have to tell you all about a great length, all about Boston Links and the Fens when we're done.
Yes.
We'll have another special video call all about that.
I love it. I'm actually very interested in that and would love to hear about it. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start by talking a bit about your career and then really focusing on some of the things that you yourself are passionate about as pertains to that career you've had. Talk about perhaps some artists and creators other than yourself. But we've talked a lot of late about different aspects of your career during my day job with Forbidden Planet TV. But one of the things that we've not got to cover off and I would like to ask you about is when you made your transition from the UK, from illustrating for 2000 AD and whatnot, and you first went over and started working for DC.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the genesis of Camelot 3000?
Oh, well, I don't have to go through how I made the leap into American comics by that Green Lantern, those few Green Lanterns. I think we've covered that.
We definitely talked about that when we had there's an interview which I'll link to for anybody listening to this, which is a chat that I had with both Brian and with Dave Gibbons last summer. Yeah. For Forbidden Planet TV, and I'll put that in the show notes to this episode. So anybody who's interested in that story can go and check that out.
Well, I mean, back at the time, I needed, you know, full-time employment. I needed regular work. And my heart belonged to DC Comics, it has to be said. My first comics experiences were buying early well, not early DC Comics, because they'd been going since the 30s, but for me the earliest was in 61 with some of their mystery titles and Green Lantern, Atom, and things of that sort.
Yes.
And I loved it. I had a great collection of DC Comics, and America seemed like a very long way away, and all of those wonderful stars of the American comics scene, you know, Gil Kane, Carmine Infante, you know, Julia Schwartz, all of Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito, all of those artists that I love, it was absolutely wonderful to go and actually be in their presence. You know, you sort of feel very honoured to be with these people who've been doing this since the dawn of time. So then to be given a proper gig, a full-time project with DC, was a big step for me. And it did mean full-time, serious, hard employment for me. I had to work many hours to get those. I've forgotten how many pages per issue, but it was a 12-issue miniseries. We were getting on for 300 pages of that series. Now, what do you really need to know about it? We had to determine it. Mike Barr was the writer.
Mike Barr was the writer. I tell you a jumping-off point for for me about this. I was a big fan of Camelot 3000, and I've got all the issues of it, or I did until I recently sold my collection on account of my mum and dad downsizing. But it was a process that I controlled, so I was happy with it. But I seem to remember reading at the time that you did some experimentation with how you actually illustrated Camelot 3000. And I remember, and this isn't a story I might have read 25, 30 years ago, something about you experimented with a different kind of pen that might have enabled you to do essentially a combined version of pencils and inks. Is that right?
Well, I mean, with issue number two, I mean, this was the first time really I had regularly been just the penciler and somebody else would be inking the whole thing. And I was never really very happy with that. There were times back in the 2000 AD days when, because of time pressures, people, friends of mine, Dave Gibbons, Gary Leach, various people inked my Judge Dredd work. But the idea of somebody regularly being my inker was something I was a little bit hard for me to swallow, but there was no way I was going to get that many pages drawn every month. So to begin with, they gave me a choice of two inkers. Mike DiCarlo was one of them.
Yeah.
I don't actually know. I can't even remember what he did. And if you're watching this, Mike, I apologize. And Bruce Patterson was another guy, and we chose Bruce to be the regular inker.
Yeah.
For the book. But he, for some reason, he only got through the first five issues. And by the time number six came along, we were in a bit of a crisis. And the story is that loads of people inked issue number six, including Dick Giordano, who was quite an important figure at DC Comics.
Of course.
And I've heard stories that all kinds of people ink that issue. You know, I think the cleaner had a go at some of the pages. But it looked all right. It wasn't one of the best. But by the time we got to the number seven, we took on Terry Austin,
who's the great Terry Austin.
Yes, a terrific artist. Who I think he'd been working on X-Men prior to that. He had a very chiseled style, which was it wasn't my style. My lines are very scalloped. They come to a point.
Yeah.
This is getting very technical, but his...
People are interested in with you, Brian. Yeah.
It's a very much chiseled. You see, I used to ink with a brush, so at all times I could draw a line which came to a point, started with a point, actually, and then swelled.
Yeah.
His lines were done with a pen of some sort. I've never really understood those pens they use, Crowquill or something like that. So his lines were quite chiselly, but I was looking at one of the recent editions of the whole thing, and I love his inks. They're so chunky. Yep. They don't lose. I didn't feel that anything I'd drawn was lost at all. It was enhanced by his really chunky. In fact, there's a lot of energy in that stuff, you know, between me penciling and him inking that I really probably wouldn't be able to do today.
Ah, that's so interesting. I always enjoyed his work and thought that what I remember about Camelot 3000 particularly is I never really saw the invasive effect of other inkers working on your pencils. And at the time,
no.
Perhaps knowing less about, you know, artwork than I do now, and not from the sense that I'm myself, I'm an artist, of course not, I'm a journalist, as you know, but I do love comics and I've read many of them. It seemed to me that back then, looking at it, I thought that was something to do with the fact that your pencils are so tight and are not in, you know, so detailed in the first place that you're not really giving the inkers much of a margin to interpret your work.
I pencil them to death. You know, the reason why the last two issues were so ridiculously late was because I was penciling, you know, every inked line was there in pencil, and I'm left-handed. So the poor old inkers had to somehow turn the page over and draw all those lines as if they were left-handed. Yeah, you're right. There wasn't really much room for them to go wrong, really. But,
I mean, that is very interesting to me, because Austin, of course, had a great partnership with John Byrne on the X-Men for a long period of time.
He did.
And I remember when Byrne flipped from doing X-Men to then writing and doing the art for Fantastic Four. And that's the point at which Byrne started inking himself. I always actually preferred Byrne when he was inked by Terry Austin than when Byrne actually inked his own work. You know, I thought suddenly there's a change in the quality of it. Whereas Austin's work on you reminded me, I'm going to name a completely different artist now, a completely different inker, but reminded me of when you look at your pencils on Camelot 3000 and you look at like your pencils inked by Terry, and then you look at, say, Kirby on the later New Gods, and then you see Kirby inked by Mike Royer. There's no real difference. Royer's like really, you know, really respecting the spirit of Kirby. There's no interpretation there. It's just absolute loyalism, it seems to me. And that's kind of that's very much, it seems, the relationship that Terry had with your pencils.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I don't really think I gave him room to improvise. You know, there weren't bits where I sort of left it out and said, "Terry, fill in that bit the way you like." You know, even most of the time, pencilers in the bits that are supposed to end up black, they leave it white but put a little X in there. And I think, if I remember correctly, I actually sort of fill the whole thing with pencil myself. So yeah, I think he was very respectful. I think the whole thing worked well.
Yeah.
And as for Kirby, I mean, he's such a stylist, isn't he? Or wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
I mean, I suppose if Vinnie Coletta or somebody like that had inked him, you'd be able to tell.
Yeah. But, well, I think Coletta's the most famous example of somebody who's considered to have sort of interfered with Kirby's intent, for want of a better description. Although I always heard that Kirby himself didn't mind Coletta's inks that much, that it was less of a Kirby issue than it was other people.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I was a huge Gil Kane fan.
Oh, so good.
I mean, he as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, he was the artist I could provide samples of my attempts to draw like Gil Kane. You know, those funny kind of, and I was able to, through the early 60s through to the late 60s, I was able to see his metamorphosis almost from a very naturalistic artist to almost like a Marvel style exaggerator of everything, you know.
Yeah.
All those sort of distorted and foreshortened limbs he used to draw. And he always had Murphy Anderson. Well, he often had Murphy Anderson as his inker. Occasionally, he would have a fellow called Sid Green, who I was also a fan of. Sid Green was an artist who used to draw for Julius Schwartz in Strange Adventures in the 50s. He drew and penciled and inked his own work. He always had a very strange barrel-chested figures. They always had a strange physique to them. Yeah, but his inking style was very, I don't know quite what tool he used, but I went through a phase early on in my teens when I discovered repeatographs of doing lots of little scratchy little lines, and he did a few Green Lantern. I always hate doing that in cinemas.
It's the worst. And you sit there trying to suppress it and you can't, and it just makes things worse.
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of go in the cinema and I think, oh, God, am I going to be able to get through this without having a coughing fit? Anyway, it's going away. Anyway, what I was saying was Sid Green inked a few of the, well, in particular, the covers on Gil Kane on Green Lantern. And only recently I was reading how somebody was complaining about his style. He used to use a toothbrush, you know, this stipple effect.
Yeah.
I don't know whether a lot of other artists did that, but I had a period when I tried the stipple effect. You know, you load ink onto your toothbrush,
and
just splash it on the page, and you get stars or something like that. But I like Sid Green's work.
But
I was just going to go on to say that eventually Gil Kane, he was obviously fast enough that he could then say, look, I don't really need an inker.
Yeah.
And his work was, to my view, look, after seeing him ink by Murphy Anderson, who was a very smooth inker, Gil Kane's penciling and inking of his own work looked rather scratchy to me.
I couldn't agree more. And I think for me, Murphy Anderson had very much had a very strong identity. So somebody who doesn't have a style like his, but I would say the same thing about, whose work I also absolutely loved, is Wally Wood. And Wally Wood and Murphy Anderson, whoever they ink, you can tell they've worked on the page, right? And I think that Kurt Swan's artwork never looked better than when Murphy Anderson was his inker.
I agree.
So that early 70s Denny O'Neill scripted sequence in Superman, you know, Kryptonite, Nevermore, and the weird kind of sand doppelganger of Superman. Yeah, that whole thing, it's when Clark Kent becomes a TV anchor. I just think Superman, Kurt Swan Superman, never looked better than it did in that era.
I loved Kurt Swan's art on Jimmy Olsen. I really liked his non-superhero stuff. So when they were just standing around in their suits with Perry White in the office and Lois Lane was there. If he hadn't had to draw guys in skin-tight suits, I'm sure Kurt Swan would have been a terrific like newspaper artist.
1,000%. In fact, you could say he might have actually missed his vocation because I think that's a very good point. His to this day, when I think Daily Planet, I think of the way that Kurt Swan drew. But the Perry White in my mind is Kurt Swan's Perry White. And as you say, it's his Lois Lane. It's his Jimmy Olsen. And it's his Clark Kent. And I think that's such a good point because I actually always found Kurt Swan's Superman to be relatively static looking.
I sold my DC collection a good few years ago. But before doing so, I scanned 2,500 covers so that I could look at them instantly. Yeah. I was looking through a whole load of, because there, you know, obviously on Facebook there's a sort of Silver Age comic fans group, nerdy fan group, and somebody was putting, oh, this is my Jimmy Olsen collection or this is my Action Comics, and I'm looking at them, there's not a lot of action on those covers. There are situations going on. There's one where Jimmy Olsen is turning into a porcupine or something like that. But there is none of this kind of sock 'em in the eye kind of action that you get from, say, a Kirby cover or a Marvel cover at all. It was just, you know, people standing in line waiting to see who was going to get to kiss Superman, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, Matt, it's great, but it absolutely, the Superman, you've hit the nail on the head though. Superman, probably from the era of the George Reeves TV show, almost really until Byrne kind of revived it all. It's very static for that 25-year period. It's like
I don't mind that because my work is static. I mean, one of my great failings or strengths, depending on which way you look at it, is I tend not to draw action. I mean, I'll get into that, but I do find that most of my people are not really moving very much.
Now, it's interesting.
We'll get into that.
It's interesting to hear you say that, and I would like to get into that in a second. I'm just going to segue into talking a little bit more about Gil Kane for a second, because there's a particular Kane run I wonder if you've ever seen, and you know that DC in the late 60s produced a very short run of Captain Action Comics, which it personally took me years to figure out on the back end what the concept of Captain Action was. And I, at the time, being English, didn't have any real appreciation of the fact that he's essentially a, you know, kind of action man that you could dress up in different.
Oh, is that what he was? I vaguely remember. Didn't he have a sort of
had a great outfit that was designed by Wally Wood, I think.
And
he had a great look to him, but the concept of the toy is that you could dress them as a variety of other famous comic book and cartoon characters. So you get, you get a Superman outfit. You'd even get but some really interesting ones, like you could get a Sergeant Fury outfit for Captain Action, stuff like that. But of course, the concept of the book is that he finds a bunch of kind of supercharged doubloons, all of which give him different powers depending upon what he's got in his pocket any one time. And the book was written, I think, by Jim Shooter. But the reason I bring it was an early and very young Jim Shooter. It was an early foray into licensed comics for DC. The guy who owns Captain Action now, one of the two guys who owns Captain Action now, is a mate of mine called Ed Cato. Runs he's a professor at Ithaca University. He runs the Ithacon, stuff like that. He's a great bloke. But the reason I'm mentioning this is that from issue 3 onwards, Gil Kane took over as the penciler.
I think he did, yes.
Yeah, the villain in Captain Action is Dr. Evil. And there's a very interesting kind of family element to Captain Action, because his sidekick, Action Boy, is his actual son. Not his warder, his adopted son, it's his actual son. And his late wife figures in part of the story, and Dr. Evil is his father-in-law, and so it's got a level of family that you, because nearly everybody in comics up to that point was like an orphan, or if they had a teenage sidekick, they'd be their ward, they wouldn't ever actually be their biological son. Captain Action kind of changed all that. But one thing that really stuck with me about the entire run is the fifth issue is just amazing to look at.
And this was a DC, was it?
It was DC, and
can you think can you think of what year we're in?
Yeah, almost 68 or 69, I think.
Oh.
And the final issue is basically Captain Action encounters a kind of schizophrenic dictator who, on one side of his personality, is a crusader for good, on another side is this Oswald Mosley type figure. But that one issue, it's Gil Kane inked by Wally Wood, and when I saw that, it just completely blew my mind, because I thought Wally would have this trick somehow of, even though he could ink people, you'd think, well, his style's not at all complimentary. And yet the work they did when you saw it would just look amazing. This one issue, that's the only example I've seen of Kane inked by Wally Wood. Even if there are others, I've not seen it. But I just think the artwork looks amazing. And it's like whenever Wood inked Ditko, that Ditko Wood combination looked incredible as well, even though it's very different from how Ditko normally looks. I know that Ditko was a big fan of working with Wood, and I just wondered if you'd encountered that Wood those Wood combinations yourself.
Did Wood draw for Warren much?
I think he did at one point. Yes, I think that's correct.
I mean, I had a decent collection of Creepies and Eeries, and there were a lot of artists in there. I don't have them anymore, so I couldn't look up and see whether Wally Wood was in there. But I've got, in my cupboard over there, I've got quite a few underground, 60s underground comics.
One of them,
and I don't even know, Slow Death or something like that, or Big City Comics, I think it was called. I should have had it prepared, really. It's got some Wally Wood in it, and it was really porno. A lot of big-boobed pornographic stuff was being done by a lot of those artists. Even Neil Adams did quite a bit of it, didn't he, in there? I think we need to throw some up on the screen, don't we, really?
If we do a YouTube version of this, that's exactly what I'll do. I think you're onto something there, because Wood did a lot of stuff. If I recall, he did quite a lot of Playboy stuff. Like, he did.
Oh, was that what it was? Yes.
Yeah. Didn't he do like Little Annie Fanny or something like that for Playboy? I think. I remember.
Wasn't that Ron? Oh no, that was Oh Wicked Wonder. Ron Embleton did Wicked Wonder.
I'm getting mixed up there. I'm talking about Russ Heath.
Kurtzman. Who did Little Annie Fanny?
Russ Heath did it for a bit, didn't he?
Oh, did he? Was him.
Because have you ever heard that story about Russ Heath? It hit some deadline, and basically Hef gets him over to the Playboy Mansion, right? And he's got to do about 5 days of concentrated work. So they set him up in a room at the Playboy Mansion. When he finishes the work, he realizes that he's a single guy at the time. Nobody's telling him to leave. And it's like basically parties with Playboy bunnies every night and and food on tap 24/7. So Russ, he just stayed there and worked from the Playboy mansion.
I did not know that.
And he was there for a considerable period of time. It's like 3 months or something. When finally, you know, at some point Hefner or one of his oppos kind of goes, "Hey, Russ, what are you doing here?" He goes, "Oh, you know, I moved in when I worked on that." And they're like, "Where have you been here ever since?" Yeah, and he was like, "Yeah." And at that point, he was politely asked to leave, but not after he'd apparently got full value out of everything that was on offer at the time from living in the Playboy mansion.
Like that, I'm afraid. I don't think I've got anything close to that.
So Brian, when you went from Camelot, so once Camelot 3000 was complete, how much time elapsed between Camelot 3000 and The Killing Joke?
Well, I tend to lapse into pre-scripted stories here because I've told these stories a few times.
Of course.
I'll throw in a few extra details maybe. Dave Gibbons and Kevin O'Neill, Robin Smith and me, and one or two others used to meet monthly in pubs and so on, such places and that, and have a meal together. And Dave showed us page by page some of the work he was doing on Watchmen, which was, you know, fantastic. And you could tell it was going to be absolutely marvelous and something really very special.
He was very excited
about it. But when I was finished on Camelot, which was before a little bit before then, it had done reasonably well. And they, out of the blue, they just sent me a bonus of a little bit of money. And I spent that going to China. My wife and I went to, I had a month or so in China and places like that. And coming back, I knew I really needed to get back to work. And so I just rang up Dick Giordano and said, "Look, and you might be able to recite this with me because I've told this story a few times. Dick, what shall I do now?" And he said, "Well, you can do anything you like." And, you know, Alan Moore was, you know, one of the 2000 AD crowd, and he was clearly a very, very, and he was the big thing now, of course, because Watchmen was doing so well, and he was my pal. Yeah. And so I said, "I'd like to draw a Batman graphic novel, and I'd love it if Alan could write it." And so they contacted Alan, and he said, "Yes." Now, I have heard stories that The Killing Joke, which comes under a bit of criticism for various reasons from people, was it really just some Batman annual story that Alan had got up his sleeve anyway? Whether that's true, I don't know. But the whole point, the whole genesis of The Killing Joke was me being told I could do anything I wanted and I could choose who to write it. Fairly soon after returning, after a month away, I got the go-ahead for that. And I spoke to Alan on the phone and Alan said, "What sort of thing do you have in mind?" And I like the idea of it being a Joker, focused on the Joker more than Batman, because he's more of the sort of character I can get my teeth into. He's almost got more dimension to him than Batman. I mean, Batman is almost like this sort of shadow on the wall.
Yeah,
I don't really feel I need to know a lot about Batman. He's just this kind of sort of. Well, he's not a vampire exactly, but I mean, he's a sort of a cloaked, mysterious figure. Whereas the Joker, I think, was more something to explore there. I mean, not only that, but there's something more to draw. There are many more poses you could put him in. Yeah. He's very much a theatrical character, as I think is the Penguin. I love drawing the Penguin as well. Yeah. I've said this before, but those two characters, they're sort of almost a sort of pre, you know, what, a silent movie.
Yes, of course.
A lot more to draw there.
Yeah.
So but I think your question was, how long was it before we got onto that? And
the reason I asked that is purely so we could evolve into talking about what you're mentioning now. And I think it is very interesting, your take on those characters. I think what you've just said, I'm sure you've said it before, but I've not read that before, or heard you say it before. Oh. I think it's very interesting, the fact that that's part of your inspiration for your take on the Batman villains, are the great silent movie era villains that would turn up in the Buster Keaton movies, in the Charlie Chaplin movies, in the silent Laurel and Hardys. You know, so you get these, get those very, you know, because actors were cast, but nowadays, actors are often quite homogenized. They all kind of look like each other, all incredibly good looking, very charismatic. But back then, it was much more like, you know, villains were telegraphing their villainy with these and Rondo Hatton, for example, who, by the way, mate, one of my first references, one of the first times I ever saw Rondo Hatton was when you drew him in Judge Dredd. I was a kid at the time, and when I read that, I knew because of the context that it had to be a reference
film or other.
I didn't know what it was, and it took me a while to figure out before I actually saw.
Along with collecting these comics, I was also a big collector of famous monsters of film. There's all those wonderful black and white, the interior pages of that were black and white, and people like Rondo Hatton and all of those kind of black and white movie horror, you know, Lon Chaney and all of those characters, you know, I loved them. And I was fascinated by, well, Freaks, actually. Todd Browning's Freaks was a bit of a fascination of mine, a sort of morbid fascination. But also The Elephant Man, actually, that came into it as well. Rondo Hatton, Tor Johnson, you know, from Planet Nine from Outer Space, people like that. He was like a Swedish wrestler, apparently.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was.
But it was only later in life that I discovered that the covers of Famous Monsters were painted by Basil Gogos. I didn't know that name at all. And the brilliance of Gogos was that he was able to take an entirely black and white world of the old Warner Brothers or whatever, black and white monster horror movies, and render them in lurid, brilliant colour that they never had in the first place for the covers of those issues. I don't know whether you have the rights to throw any of those on screen.
Those are very familiar to me. And you've just explained something about what gave those titles incredible energy. Until you told me now, I never knew the name of that artist. But
no, I didn't know him either.
Struck by his work. It was incredible. Yeah.
And he lived till quite very recently. He was even on Facebook recently, until the last few years.
Wow, amazing.
I think he must have lived in, nice guy by the look of it. Very tight. As far as I know, he only ever drew faces. I've not seen any of his other work.
So hearing you talk about this, Brian, I mean, I used to love it in those early days of your career, like when on Dredd, you used to introduce, you know, Laurel and Hardy, I think, appear in the kind of the oxygen board episode on the moon. And I remember really super clearly, I've actually talked to you about this before, thinking about it, on one of the Walter the Wobot backup strips. He's on some kind of Britain's Got Talent type show, and there's a variety of judges, one of whom is a well-known actress, one of whom is Marilyn Monroe, I think, if I remember correctly.
Really? Okay.
But one of whom is Adolf Hitler, who and the gag is that he's introduced as Adolf Schickelgruber. And I used to love the way that you dropped in real-life characters like that. And there are some characters from movies that I've always thought I would love to see you just do an illustration of, a cover, if you will, just a standalone illustration. And I'll tell you who some of them are, and I don't know if you're familiar with any of these films. But have you ever seen the 1947 film Kiss of Death?
Kiss of Death.
Yeah, it's got Victor Mature, and it's got Richard Widmark in it, in the role that made him a star.
Really?
And he's, you know, fourth or fifth down the cast list, right, in terms of his billing. But he plays a kind of snickering, laughing assassin called Tommy Udo, who's clearly hopped up on pills and whatnot. But it's kind of a Batman villain performance. It's definitely one of the factors that must have influenced Frank Gorshin as the Riddler, but with a homicidal energy. But whenever I watch that movie, I'm like, oh man, I would love to see Brian draw this.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought you were going to say Kiss Me Deadly, which is the Mickey Spillane movie.
Well, I mean, this is so funny that you should say that, because in my hand to God's ear. That is exactly what I was going to say next. And I because I'm a huge fan of that film. And one of the things we may have talked about
as
in the past
is Tarantino, I think, isn't
he? Yeah. He absolutely is. And one of the things I do on the side at Titan is I edit Max Allen Collins' Mike Hammer novels. That he completes the Mickey Splaine's Mike Hammer novels, and I'm the editor on those books because I'm a huge Hammer fan. But
was that Mike Hammer in Kiss Me Deadly? Was he
it
the
was,
lead?
Yeah,
he's lead the character.
He's the lead character, absolutely. And
he's so brutal.
He's incredibly brutal. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Even with his clients.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And it's a kind of it's quite an unbelievable performance actually, because Ralph Meeker runs through that film at such a heightened peak of energy and emotion the whole time. He almost shouts at everybody he talks to and threatens everybody he talks to, even when it's Velda, his secretary/girlfriend. You know, he just pushing everybody around, And the interesting thing is that the early Hammer novels are basically Hammer is back from the war, and he's this vengeance-fueled, constantly angry character who's clearly got some kind of PTSD. He's come back from war.
PTSD. I've never read any. I don't know the characters at all apart from that. I mean, I know the Raymond Chandler characters.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I've never read any Mickey Splaine.
Well, Mickey Splaine is like literally the emotions are just dialed up to 11 the whole time,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's real purple prose, but it's an amazing, very, very faithful performance that Mika gives. But there are so many scenes again in Kiss Me Deadly. There's several kind of vignettes in that film where I've always thought where he's got the guy who's the orchestra conductor. And he's threatening him and he jams his conducting hand in a drawer. Or there's a guy that he just throws down a flight of stairs. Or there's the whole kind of opening sequence, which is actually with a very young Cloris Leachman, where he finds her. So because the film begins and he's like driving through the Hollywood Hills and it's nighttime, and all you see is everything via the, you know, via the...
Really? These films are so... from so long ago, it's probably been 30 or more years since I've seen these things. I don't know whether you watch them over and over again, do you? But
I've got the kind of brain that absorbs them. I wrote about films for a long time, so I guess it just keeps them, you know, at the forefront of my mind.
Yes, yes. I think, I'm a real film buff, but I think the stuff I like tends to be a little bit more recent. We had a local film club, and one of our members insisted on only ever showing films from the 50s.
Yeah, right.
They all seem to have Burt Lancaster in them.
Which kind of makes sense.
I thought, you know, they have made films since then. One of my absolute favourite films was called Nashville. It was by Robert Altman.
I love that movie.
I love it. And before I watched that, I wasn't really a country music fan, but I've since become one. But I love that film. I love the fact that there are 25 lead characters in there, all of which get equal time, really.
And that was something Altman, of course, did a couple of times. He took that approach to a number of movies.
He did. He did one called A Wedding.
It's phenomenal. I saw that when I was a kid in Crosby in Liverpool by myself in a cinema where I was the only person in there. The classic in Crosby, a matinee on a Saturday, and I was literally the only person in the cinema.
Oh, really? Well, we've actually been to the cinema locally here when my wife and I have been the only two people.
Brilliant.
In fact, I'll tell you one thing. Last year they released Tenet?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And my wife and I were the only people in the room, and I'm afraid after an hour we left. Because
now I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you what you thought of it. Because I've got a lot of admiration for Chris Nolan, but I think sometimes, you know, sometimes he kind of almost strays into an Emperor's New Clothes thing, where he's phenomenally talented. But I personally didn't really like Interstellar that much, mainly because I don't like the central MacGuffin, which is there's this whole thing about like finding out the secret to like the faster than light drive or what have you. And of course, that's virtually fucking physically impossible. So the reason it's built around this MacGuffin, although he loves all this science and everything, and he tries to get all the theory of relativity stuff right, there's a conceit at the center of that, which is like, well, that just will never work. You know,
he's very interested in time. I mean Memento was a terrific idea. I thought that worked quite well.
I agree. Yeah.
And I could sort of see what he was doing with Tenet.
Yeah.
But I had to read about it because after an hour or so of it, I found the Kenneth Branagh's part very... Kenneth Branagh being a Russian, I just, you know, I think I'm a little bit over Kenneth Branagh.
Wholly inauthentic. I love Kenneth Branagh, but he's got to be in the right thing. I mean, I thought he was great in Wallander on television. I thought he was amazing in that.
Yeah, okay.
You know, but I think I agree with you completely. Your experience of Tenet is exactly mine.
Well, I think my problem was I don't really like James Bond. I don't really like super spies.
Yeah.
And I just found it all a bit... this whole world. And by the time they did that business with the truck, you know, when they had to sort of break into a truck that was actually driving, my wife enjoyed it, but I found it incredibly staged.
Yeah, I know, and it's absolutely a set piece where the filmmaker's essentially going, look at how clever I am.
Look at how clever, but I mean, the whole idea of, I mean, I understand that by the time we get to the end of the film, we're going to see the same film, but in reverse.
Yeah.
You've seen the whole thing, so you can confirm that. And I feel I ought to buy it from the Tesco's or somewhere and just sit down and watch it just so I get...
I mean, just to have the complete experience, I guess. But I do absolutely think that my experience with it was I enjoyed it the whole way through. But I enjoyed it the whole way through with a huge but, and that was that at the end, I wasn't really sure what the fuck had gone on. And I'm somebody who has spent, you know, 30 years of my life watching films for a living and writing about them, you know. Not that that means anything, but except other than I'm used to watching films and, you know, getting pretty much what's going on fairly, you know, straight away.
I am losing my attention. I'm losing my attention. I watched a film only the other day called The Handmaiden.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. By the Korean guy.
Yes,
his name, and I'm afraid I came away from that thinking, what the hell went on in that? You know, why did he have his fingers chopped off? I mean, spoiler alert, folks. Who was tricking who? And I think possibly if I'd had, you know, concentrated harder, I might have got it. But did you get that one?
No, I only know about that film and have not seen it. And I have to say...
Well, I've spoiled it for it.
Don't worry, mate. You're not really selling it to me, so I'm not going to jump up the must-watch list.
There was another film I saw recently that was a puzzler, and it was called I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Now, I hear good things about that. Well, did you enjoy it?
By the end of it, it was a real head-scratcher. It's what I would call a head-scratcher. And I actually had to go online to read what had actually happened in the film. Once I'd read what had happened in the film, I thought, oh, I get it now. But it's a little bit Emperor's New Clothes. You know, I might have been thinking, well, you know, I suppose I should really like this. But I won't tell you anymore because you'll probably watch it one day.
This is so funny.
I could go on about films of all sorts of periods.
It's funny. It's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. And this is a really nice segue, the concept of having to go away and look at another source to confirm what you think. I just want to touch upon one final slice of conversation about The Killing Joke. Because a couple of years ago, he was the chap, like Grant Morrison came up with his view of what is going on at the end of The Killing Joke. And I wanted specifically to ask you about that and to ask it for you, because, you know, I had always just read and enjoyed The Killing Joke and thought, well, it's an ambiguous note on which it's ending. But he had a completely unambiguous take on what the ending of The Killing Joke is. What is it to you, Brian?
Well, I have read some of this conspiracy theory. There was nothing in the script to suggest there was anything ambiguous about it. The two of them just have a bit of a laugh. Let's have a think. When I was drawing it, there is a sort of a hand that goes between the two of them that some people think, you know, there's some sort of death stroke of some sort. there was no, I think there was no intention on Alan's part to have it as a death scene, and there was no intention on my part to have it as a death scene. So in that respect, it isn't a death scene. Yes. But I was just watching this thing podcast on over here with Philip Pullman, and he was saying when you're writing something, you know, you are, what is the word he used? You're an autocrat or something. You are, but once you've finished the thing, it's then in the hands of the readers, and they can interpret anything the way they want. So they may know more about that final scene than we ever intended to put into it.
Yeah.
How's that for an answer?
I think it's a great answer because the interpretation that Batman is the Grant Morrison interpretation that Batman is executing the Joker and that the clue has been in the title the entire time, the Killing Joke.
Yeah,
I had never considered it until he said it, and then when I deliberately reread the book just from that standpoint, I thought, well, actually, yeah, you can interpret it this way, because there's an interesting thing that happens also on the dialogue on the final page where the Joker's laughter stops before Batman's does it. Yeah? And
that,
a lot of people have put that together and said, oh, right, Batman's just fucking killed him. That's why they suddenly stopped laughing. And, you know, it kind of makes sense, you know what I mean? But,
well, they're probably right. I mean...
but to hear you talk about it, to hear you talk about what the intent was is very interesting.
Well, I don't want to spoil things, but the intent was not that either on Alan's or my part, as far as I... Well, if it had been, he would have communicated to me that I had to draw it that way, but he didn't. I think there are one or two other examples where I've drawn two characters together, and for some reason there's a hand in shadow in between the two. Maybe it's just a way I draw. I mean, there are a couple of other things about the Killing Joke that I only grew to love afterwards, and one of them is the fact that the cover is a lot more horrible than you'd imagine, because it is the moment when the Joker is doing the worst thing of all. He's, because you know what's at the other end of that camera.
Yes.
If you read the story. So although it's a very friendly and very familiar, sort of iconic, because we've seen it so often, image, it's actually an image of the moment when it is the worst thing happening.
Yeah.
In there. But also later on, there's a moment that I love the most, regardless of all the, apart from all of these things about the thing about the final page, I love the bit where the Joker draws the gun that apparently has terribly harmed Barbara, and points it at Batman and shoots the Batman with that gun.
Yeah.
And out of it comes a flag that says click, click, click.
Yeah.
And he says, damn, it's empty. It's just mad. It's there's a level of madness to that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine that the Joker is just he's playing at it. He's a theatrical villain in a way, isn't he?
Yes.
But the look of surprise on his face that the gun is empty. But not only is the gun empty, but it's got a bloody flag sticking with the words. That's almost my favourite bit in the whole story. Anyway.
Oh, that is fantastic to hear. Thanks for your candor, Brian. I really enjoyed hearing that. And just to carry on talking about the Joker for a second, because we started talking about the Joker earlier. It's very interesting and gratifying as a fan of your work and appreciative of your work to hear how much you'd like the Joker as a character, because I think something you've often managed to do in the history of all those great DC illustrations and covers, you've managed to redefine the Joker's look several times over during the time. Your Joker hasn't remained static in one kind of place. I think you play around with the edges of his appearance quite a bit.
Well, I mean, I was doing the Neil Adams Joker, I think. I mean, the thing that really made me want to draw the Joker was a story that Neil Adams drew. Would it have been Denny O'Neill, the one?
It's the Joker's five-way revenge, right?
Is that the one you're talking about? The Batman is
the giant playing card.
The giant, yes.
Yeah.
And there is another story attached to that, which is a bit long-winded. But there's a moment in that story where he's just walking along the road, the pavement, as we call it, the sidewalk, with his henchpersons, his henchmen. I don't know quite what his henchman does, but he just thinks it would be funny to push him in front of a bus.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of murderous joke, isn't it? And I thought that's a level of kind of comical insanity that I could imagine in this story. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'd had no say whatsoever in the writing of The Killing Joke at all. I had some of the say in the writing of Camelot.
Yeah.
Because Mike Barr did ask me what I thought could go on later on in the story, and I invented the mother, the big giant multi-egg-sacked alien creature for the latter stages of Camelot, but I had nothing, I had no say in the writing of The Killing Joke at all.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. And in that, in this last, I guess it must be since The Killing Joke, is it 30 years or so, seeing that time you've been mainly... Well,
it was 1988, wasn't it?
So wow,
that's,
yeah.
That's okay. A long time ago.
It is a long time ago now, you're absolutely right. So in your long career illustrating covers for DC, are there any that stand out as real favourites of yours?
Well, you have different favourites on different days, don't you? And I mean, I drew Animal Man. I don't know how you could probably... I mean, I don't expect you to know everything about me because you've got a lot of artists and writers in the comic world to remember.
Yeah.
But I drew quite a few, 60-odd...
Oh, I remember them very clearly.
Consecutive Animal Man covers. And that was great fun because that was really Grant Morrison revealing himself as another special writer. I think at the beginning when he arrived at DC, my theory is they didn't want him on the big names, so let's give him this kind of 10th-rate character that has been retired for the last 20 years, Animal Man. And he turned him into this kind of meta character, didn't he? With, I think, number 4, we actually had my hand drawing him, and he was in a sort of crucifix.
Yes.
Kind of
position. Yeah.
I don't know whether you can put... Can you put that on the screen just there?
Yeah. No, so, I mean, it's very memorable to me. I bought those issues in real time, month by month.
Yeah.
As they came out.
But I mean, I've got a comical... I love kind of... The thing you get from Judge Dredd that often is lacking from American comics is the combination of hard action, even horror, and comedy.
Yes.
I mean, you certainly get it with, like, you know, the Fink gang or whatever they are, and people like that, you know, the League of Fatties and
Otto
Stump and all those wonderfully horrific but comical characters. And I think I was able to incorporate a kind of comical element, dimension to, I mean, you know, I was only the cover artist. I mean, other people did the real hard work. Charles Truog, for instance, drew most of the early issues, and then later Rick Veitch, was it? Various people.
I think this approach is very much where you came into your own on, I think it was great on Animal Man, but I think that confluence of kind of the macabre and action and comedy, your Invisibles covers are all about that, I think.
Oh, the Invisibles cover. Well, you see, that was when I went digital, you see. That was that was Grant Morrison, and his work is so psychedelic and sort of metaphysical and odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
That it was, and at the time, Shelley Roberg was the, who became Shelley Bond, was the editor of all of that, and they let me really go wild on those, some of those covers. I remember the final 12 of those covers, it was supposed to be a countdown to the millennium, and they decided to count them from 12 to 1, you know, in reverse order, so that number 1 would occur at the right on the millennium, because everything gets late and it wasn't finished on time. But it was great fun sort of incorporating the number 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, all the way back to 1 as some kind of element, several elements really within these covers. And I was given pretty much free range to do what I liked. I remember number 1, I was especially asked to have an arm coming out of a lake.
Yeah.
And I just took a photograph of my wife's arm actually holding a gun.
Oh, brilliant.
Which I photoshopped coming out of it. So I was really at the time mucking around with Photoshop, just, you know. Dave Gibbons introduced me to Photoshop.
Yeah.
Because people were colouring my line. You know, I was drawing Flash, I think, as well. And that was probably a bit later. But a lot of the work I was doing for DC was just line work. And then Tatiana Wood or a number of other colorists would add the color. But then as the computer entered the scene, the colorist would be using a lot of computery whiz-bang effects. And the original line work that I put down on the paper in the first place was getting a little bit swamped. And I thought, if anyone's going to swamp my drawings with colour, it needs to be me.
Yeah. So you always colour your own covers?
At the moment, I do it. I don't remember the last time anyone ever recoloured or ever coloured. At the moment, I produce, in every case, I produce completely full colour work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also let them, because, you know, you do the work in Photoshop and you send it via some, I send it via, I think, or WhatsApp. No, not, yeah, not yeah. WhatsApp.
WeTransfer.
And I send them the colour file of it and also the line file, because there's always a line. The line drawing itself has got to stand on its own for me, because, you know, we come out of a tradition, we Brits, of comics in black and white. You know, they had to work without any colour, and I still like the I'm not a painter. I really can't work with paint. And I like the drawing to stand on its own with, you know, a good degree of line and detail and dark and shape, light and shade. So I always send the work in colour and also in line, so they can use that if they want.
Yeah. I mean, I think your aptitude, brilliance, in fact, not just aptitude, your brilliance with line is one of the reasons why your work is so popular. And this is the element of your work that, to me as a fan, and to therefore somebody probably started reading your stuff when I was about 10, it really stood out to me from the get-go, particularly when I first encountered you and Gibbons, your artwork, at almost exactly the same time, because I was a paper boy. Issue one of 2000 AD appears at the newsagents I worked for. I bought it. I was immediately hooked. And I was a big fan of American comics. That's what I grew up on. And I didn't read many British comics until 2000 AD. No. Read the odd one, and I did at that time. I love them now, but I wasn't so into the war books at that point. But 2000 AD was, to me, the first British comic that had a kind of American sensibility, and for me that American sensibility was typified by your art and Dave's art. And then it's the same way I felt about Steve Dillon's art when they ultimately started doing, like, Nick Fury, I think, in the Marvel Hulk comic. Yeah. But I thought you guys very much had, in different ways, had a flavour that I, as an American comics fan, really, really responded to. And I think that clarity of line that you have is the thing that I just remember your work just being so impactful from the first moment that I saw it. I remember being utterly fascinated by it, because it didn't feel very British to me, even though undoubtedly being British is part of who you are. You know, I think it always made a tremendous amount of sense. The minute you started working for DC, I thought, well, that's the inevitable outcome for both you and Dave. I always thought that's what would happen.
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, before 2000 AD, we grew up on War Picture Library. I think Mick McMahon was particularly keen on those. Hotspur and, Action. But what was the one that had the shark?
Action.
Yeah. And a lot of those comics were drawn by Italians and Spanish artists. There was certainly not an American superhero-y dimension or look to any of them.
No, not at all.
But, of course, Dave and I had spent 2 years drawing this Nigerian superhero called Power Man.
Of course.
Because Barry Coker, I'm sure we've covered all that. My screen's gone blank. Just going to switch it back on again. And so I don't think superheroes had ever really worked. There had been the Spider, hadn't there?
Yeah, the Spider, started out as a villain and then became...
I never read him.
Became a hero.
Apparently, Jerry Siegel wrote that.
That's right,
Superman guy.
I don't know if you remember this, Brian, but one of the first times that we encountered each other was around the time that I was doing the first kind of reprints of the... I used to work at IPC, which is when I was the publisher of Loaded. I put together the first archive editions of The Spider and the Steel Claw, which were in fact published by Titan, where I work now.
Okay.
I used to love those strips particularly as a kid, because for me they played the most closely to the kind of American comic sensibility and wheelhouse. They did things that felt to me as an American comics fan that were not dissimilar. And
I was really delighted, by the way, with the recent collection of Steel Claw. Rebellion, was it Rebellion? Out? And I did the cover on that.
And it's so lovely.
It's a beautiful book. I mean, I don't think that. I think the cover's okay because I was really trying to make it look as if Blasco himself had drawn it.
Yeah.
I don't really care how much I swipe as long as Blasco himself is actually on the cover there. I mean, it's only the head, I think. And I think probably the head. I'm looking past you because I've got it attached to the wall over there.
It's a beautiful piece of work. And that was edited by Keith Richardson, who's a great bloke, actually.
I hope they do another one because I...
Me too.
And I've also volunteered to do the the Mighty cover, but they've they've probably got a much better artist lined up, Chris Weston or somebody who can do that.
Weston's a brilliant artist, of course, but I think it's pretty rich you saying they're going to get somebody better because I'd love to see your work.
Well, I would love to do it. I mean, Eric Bradbury was the original artist. As a kid in 1964, it was the DC Comics, but it was also the Weekly Valiant, which had this. It was such a treat. I really wanted to know what MyTech was going to destroy this week.
Well, Valiant was the cradle of all these great strips, of course. Which are very close to my heart. If Keith's listening to this, I hope he commissions you to do that MyTech cover sooner rather than later.
Was it you or somebody else? It was probably somebody else who told me that Charlie Higson of the Higsons and of the Fast Show is writing the Steel Claw or writing one of these characters.
It would have been somebody else. It's got to be one of the Rebellion guys. But he sounds exactly right. I'll tell you, funnily enough, you mentioned Chris Weston. So when I was at IPC and I was involved with the this is the early 2000s revival of those characters, which were published by DC. And I co-published the Albion series which Dave did the covers for and was written by Liam Moore and John Repien. And then I co-published Dave's Thunderbolt Jackson series, which was written by him and he did the covers and the interior art was done by John Higgins. And then we did Battle of Britain.
And who was publishing that?
It was myself at IPC and DC Comics, Wildstorm.
Yes, yes.
Then we did Battle of Britain, which was written by Garth Ennis and the art was by Colin Wilson. So the next book, the series, the line got canned after Battle of Britain, but the fourth book was going to be The Steel Claw, written by Ian Edgington and illustrated by Chris Weston. And we got to the point where myself and Bob Wayne, who you will recall, and Hank Canals, we'd all been out for dinner in the West End, and Ian and Chris, and it was all going to happen. And we were all very excited about it. And it was the one I was looking forward to the most. So I was absolutely gutted when the line fell apart and didn't go any further. It's always a shame when you know you've got a great book that's in the ether and it doesn't actually happen. It must have been even worse for the creators, but for me, it was just I remember being gutted at the time.
I was going to say that when I started out, there wasn't a 2000 AD, and all of the comics before, I wasn't sure what line of work I was going to be going into. So I tried out some DC Thompson War two pages, some mystery. There was a sort of a creepy, eerie kind of two pager I drew. I even tried girls' romance. There was sort of I did pencil drawings of for a kind of romance magazine of some sort, which I only found the other day, which I put on one of these Facebook things. So there wasn't really a suitable location for my work. You know, I was trying to kind of nudge myself in the direction of drawing Napoleonic war stories and people on horseback, and I didn't know how to do that at all. But it was very convenient that, Star Wars came along, basically, and IPC decided maybe we should try our hand again at science fiction or something.
Yeah.
Might sell. And I guess a generation that included people like Gibbons and me had grown up on Marvel and DC Comics, so we knew how to do that kind of... We knew about people like Murphy Anderson and Gil Kane and all of those very smooth artists. And those were our sort of mentors. So I guess right from that period on, 2008, he took on a slightly different look.
Yes.
Not just, I mean, there were other people, obviously, than Dave and me. But I mean, Mick came along with his completely unique style, which I love.
Yes, as does Dave. I mean,
Ian Gibson, and loads of people.
Ian Gibson, yeah, that was amazing stuff. There's the Ballard Nelly looked very different from everybody else, I thought at the time.
That's right, yeah. This is turning into a rebellion in 2018, yeah, block.
Yeah, it is.
They ought to pay us for this.
Yeah, Keith, again, if you're listening, mate, please, you know my address, just send me a check. It's all good.
Send the check. I've got a hole in my coat here. I need a new coat.
Final, on that note, I'd like to close out one more thing, which is I'd like to flip back to DC and a character. You were often name checked about illustrating the definitive version of, and it's none of the characters we talked about thus far, but it's somebody you've illustrated many. It's a character you've illustrated many covers for, and that's Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Everyone loves your iteration of Wonder Woman, and it's so often held up as the kind of standard of how Wonder Woman should be illustrated. And I can't disagree with that. I've always loved your Wonder Woman, Brian.
I've loved that for a while, yeah. Yes, I volunteered to draw the Wonder Woman covers. I was on Animal Man, I think, and Paul Kupperberg or was it Tom Pyre, who were the editors? I just, you know something, I'd really like to draw Wonder Woman because, she's a sexy character, and I thought, well, I could do that. And there were the one or two. I mean, it started with just, I did often when you don't have an idea at all. Because I mean, I like covers that have a good story suggested on them, you know. But quite often nowadays, they just say, well, give us an action cover. And I think, well, yeah, but what are they doing? So quite often I'm drawing a cover without really knowing what is going on in the story. So on a couple of occasions, I just did fairly iconic-looking pictures of Wonder Woman, and one of them with her standing on one leg. That seems to be an often reproduced image of her.
It really is. I think your Wonder Woman is the kind of perfect confluence of power, strength, confidence, and beauty. And I think every time I see Wonder Woman illustrated by you, she's always all four of those things at once. And and just the sheer power of the character. I mean, your Wonder Woman is absolutely second to no one. And that extremely, she's completely feminine, but completely powerful and in control. I think that's a wonderful thing to see. And I think that's something you've always really understood about the character.
Well, I mean, I think Adam Hughes is the definitive Wonder Woman artist. He's such a good artist. He does manage to create that. It's not exploitative. You know, the image of Wonder Woman and the women that he draws, because I think he specializes in Catwoman and Zatanna and all the other women. They're not exploitative images. I think they're images of, you know, sexy but very strong and identifiable with women, which I think even women, especially women, even might be drawn to.
I think that's very true.
I mean, back in the early days, Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito had a long period drawing Wonder Woman, and I think she was really very much in the doldrums for a long time. I think George Perez had a go at for a good while. I don't know whether he packed up or whatever, but I stepped in and just did a few, 20-odd maybe, 50, 20, I don't know. But thanks for your comments.
No, it's absolutely true. So what do you think of Gal Gadot on screen?
I think she's the most watchable DC superhero character. There's something I can't quite get my head around any of the male superheroes on screen.
Yeah.
I think she's terrific. She's such a nice woman too. I mean, when you see her being interviewed, she's so down to earth and likable and beautiful. And when she does, they do the action scenes, she seems to be getting into it.
Yeah.
I think she's great. Yeah. And apparently she's so well-trained because she was in the Israeli army, wasn't she?
Absolutely was. It's true. So. Yeah. No,
you wouldn't want to pick a fight with her, but she's absolutely great. Yeah.
I mean, she's phenomenal. She's almost so perfectly cast that she's one of those actors that, you know, you'd really have to, you'd really have to construct her in a laboratory for her to be that perfect for Wonder Woman. She's incredible. I think she's just got this towering charisma as well, extremely likable charisma.
Yeah.
Supremely capable. She's everything you would want Wonder Woman to be. And I think she's a terrific role. I know she's a terrific role model for people like my daughter, for women around the world. I don't think they could have cast her any better. And I think she was.
I was just going to say that there was a thing called International Women's Day a few years ago. And somebody suggested that image I drew of Wonder Woman standing on one leg. And they were suggesting Wonder Woman as an image for International Women's Day. And then somebody said, no, I think, possibly nowadays, now that she's on film.
Having had Gal Gadot bring her to life, having made such a success of it as well, and having been so rightly embraced in that performance, I think you're right. I think it would be a
different
outcome.
I'll tell you who else I really like. I really love, what's her name, the Harley Quinn character on screen.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course, Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. She's fantastic.
I mean, totally different from I've drawn Harley Quinn the way she was drawn by Bruce Timm or whoever. She looks completely different on screen, but I think she's so funny.
Oh, yeah.
She seems to be the one out front of the stunts. I mean, Suicide Squad was one of the very early showcase, I think. No, Brave and the Bold, number 26 or something like that, back in the late 50s. And there were other sort of dull bunch of adventurers, and so this crowd who are currently called the Suicide Squad are I think they're a bunch of villains, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was John Ostrander, the author, the writer in the 80s, who kind of repurposed them. So he took the concept of the Suicide Squad, who were, you're dead right, they're incredibly bland. I took their leader, Rip Flagg, and he basically turned it into the superhero version of the Dirty Dozen, with an ever-evolving cast, because the villains, second string villains, just keep on getting killed off. That's the point. They genuinely kill them, you know.
Yes.
But I think the new Suicide Squad movie, the one being written and directed by James Gunn, looks far more in keeping with the tone and the quality level of the comic than the first movie was. I mean, the trailer looks like it's got that insane James Gunn energy that he brought to the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, but just, you know, kicking into that whole concept of the Suicide Squad. So there's a whole bunch of second or third string DC villains in that movie, but it's quite clear that not very many of them are going to make it to the end of the film.
I really like that running gag, you know, where they say if you do something like, you know, if you do this, you're dead. If you get on the wrong side of it, you're dead.
Yeah.
And she says, if you've got a personalized number plate, you're dead.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of a gag that ran over from the previous. But I did the Marvel character, the one with Ryan, not Reynolds. Was it Ryan Reynolds?
Ryan Reynolds, Deadpool.
Deadpool. I thought Deadpool was hilarious.
Deadpool's terrific. I completely agree. Yeah, Deadpool is a wonderful piece of work. And again, because it kind of breaks the fourth wall so much, so many gags about comics themselves. I think if you're a very well-read comics fan like you are, and you're on the inside of the industry, it's a lot of fun.
Well, actually, I'm not a well-read comics fan at all, actually. I'm a very badly read comics fan because I've hardly read any of them.
Oh, I was thinking more about your Silver Age years rather than your...
Yes, I suppose, I've encountered a lot of them, and I know a lot of you know, who the characters are. I'll tell you another set of characters, if you have time.
Oh, we've totally got time, Brad.
I love Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the original Doom Patrol with Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani. I met Arnold Drake briefly, and I loved... Bruno Premiani was one of my favourite artists.
Yeah,
he did the original Doom Patrol, but the incarnation of the Doom Patrol by Grant Morrison and Richard Case.
Yeah,
that's my phone. I love that too. That was very, very sort of metaphysical and strange.
I just thought, you know, when you get characters like Danny the Street or whatever, that just such it was so rich, that series. I remember when he reset it. Well, I think the first four part arc is called Crawling from the Wreckage, and he kind of resets it. And at first, it's relatively normal. you know, and then just takes it and he just goes and goes and goes. And it's like he's doubled down on everything he's learned about doing Animal Man. And he just goes, fuck it, I'm just gonna take this. I think that's the joy of that.
During that period when Simon Bisley was doing covers, I loved his covers too.
Yeah.
And when they put the collected editions together, I pretty much begged to do the covers. I did five of those. And I did actually read all that stuff. You know, I don't always read a lot of the things I do covers for. But on this occasion, I pretty much begged to do those. I love the – was it Mr. Nobody?
Mr. Nobody,
And he has he's got an evil plan to turn every 12-inch ruler in the world into a 13-inch ruler.
What better moment to wrap up our conversation than
we've got to stop?
Yeah. The thing is, I'm conscious of the fact that we could do this for a whole other 90 minutes. And what I'd rather do, Brian, is rather than do it for another 90 minutes now, I'd love it if you could come back and we'll do a take two sometime. Not now, but maybe in a couple of months. If we have a second instalment, which, by the way, this is exactly the way the conversation with Dave went. I think with Dave, I asked him one question, two maybe, and then lo and behold, it was an hour plus later.
Well, I find with a lot of people like me is you ask them a question and the answer goes on for about 15 to 20 minutes.
Absolutely.
I
am a big fan, and I've got a very digressive conversational style anyway, and I'm a big fan of digressions, and I think it's the thing, you know, if an interview, a conversation, it's not really an interview, it's a conversation like this, was literally just I ask you a question and then you scrolled out an answer to a question being asked 1,000 times, that would be very interesting.
No.
Pulling the string on the conversation and you end up talking about Billy Fury's real name is Ronald Witcherly, you know, that's what I love about Life Will Stop, you know. So it's been a real pleasure having you on Hard Agree, and it's been a real pleasure chatting to you as always, mate.
Likewise, what can I say?
That's what I call a Hard Agree from me and a Hard Agree from Brian Bolland. And Brian, I very much look forward. Thank you for all your work. Thank you for the work we began the show with. We were genuinely, it was one of those glorious times when I wasn't just thanking you for something that I picked up and read, but something that I had a hand in conceptualizing, which is your Batman Live Building cover. That was, I know, a great pleasure for me and for Rob Pontefract at Forbidden Planet. So thank you for that. And thanks as always for being such a wonderful guest. I really enjoyed chatting with you, man.
Me too, yeah.
Well, you take care. I'll see you very soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, all the best.
Bye.
You've been listening to Hard Agree. This episode was edited by John Horsley and Kenrick Regan, and our theme music, Golden, was written and performed for this show by Liverpool's finest band, Denio. Hard Agree is a production of The Spoilerverse and myself, Andrew Sumner.